Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Sharon Lerner. She is author of the new book, The War on Moms, on life in a family-unfriendly nation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a book about basically how mothers are doing in the United States of America and the stresses that they have here that we do not have in other countries. It's a really huge difference between basically the United States and the entire rest of the industrialized world.
Yeah, in many cases, it really is about almost the entire rest of the world. In some cases, and you know, I should get specific, I really go into kind of three areas: childcare, the availability of flexible work options, and then paid leave. And paid leave, and by that I mean what people often refer to as paid maternity leave, but it's also paid parental leave. It depends on the state and you know what law we're talking about, but it's paid time off after the birth of a child. And that's the realm in which we're so far out of the global mainstream. It's pretty incredible. There are only 7 countries in the world right now that don't have paid leave, and the United States is among them. So there are 177 that do, that we know of, and that includes poor countries like Afghanistan and Haiti and Djibouti, and that Djibouti is this tiny, drought-plagued African nation. And when you think about the fact that they have managed to give their citizens 14 weeks paid after the birth of a child and we haven't, it's sort of mind-boggling.
What is going on in our mind? I mean, this is obviously, as a country, we set priorities and we follow those priorities. What is it about us that makes things like paid maternity leave so utterly low on this spectrum of things that we fund?
Well, it's interesting. It helps to look at history a little bit, at our own history and also history of other countries in terms of paid leave to understand it, I think. So one of the things I did was look at the history of paid leave and see that we had a pretty active movement around paid leave, a push for paid leave in 1919. And that's when other countries, actually many other countries, were adopting it. There was this international labor treaty going on at the time that said that women should get, I think it was 12 weeks paid. It was, you know, time off before and after birth with job protection. And 33 countries signed on. And people in this country were pushing that we signed on. And that's sort of when the first big push was happening internationally. These were rich countries pushing for it. France and Sweden, I believe, already had it and got it in the 1800s. So, you know, there were activists here at the time, or advocates, I should say, who were saying, hey, you know, we're behind. We're out of the mainstream here. We got to get this going. And, of course, that's so long ago now. And it's so what's happened since is that we've had several moments of activity on this front. One was, as I said, in 1919, then again in the Second World War, when women were taking up a lot of the jobs that men had vacated because they were fighting, there was another push. And then in the 70s, once again, what happened in 1919, we had sort of miscalculations and missed opportunities. One of the stories that killed me when I was learning about this is that in 1919, there was some infighting, and one of the issues that people were squabbling over was whether or not they should insist that paid leave be part of national health coverage, which they also thought was around the corner. So it's sort of heartbreaking to think about it. And in the Second World War, you know, men returned, obviously, from fighting, and when women left the workforce again, the pressure eased off. Then we had another push in the 70s, and that's where I think the politics really start to get intense, and you get some of the the sense of the forces that are really opposed to this. And I think a lot of it came from the business community on the grounds, one, that it would be too expensive, and two, and I think this is sort of the more insidious force that we still face, is this idea that pay leave and other kinds of protections for workers are an intrusion into the relationship between employers and employees. And I think that's part of it, and it's hard to nail down. You know, with the cost issue, it's easier to nail down because, in fact, the state paid leave programs that we have now, and there are two, there's one in New Jersey and one in California, they don't come out of employer funds. They come out of employee funds as part of a tax. So it's interesting, you know, that you can say, okay, well, the cost issue is really pretty much moot. But when you talk about this other sort of more amorphous argument that it's an intrusion on business relationships, that sort of goes to the heart of what I think has gotten in the way over the years. And it's this idea that, you know, in this country, we're different. And one of the ways we're different is that we, business reigns here, and we just don't like to interfere. And to do so in some ways is seen as un-American by some people. And that's, I think, a big part of the problem.
Well, it brings up a really deep philosophical underpinning of our country, which is that we treat people as resources to be used for profit rather than as fellow human beings. That's a very deep mental problem that we have as a country. And it comes up all the time when people say, well, the market will solve our problems. But what, of course, that looks like on the ground is that bosses feel that they have the right to harass a woman for taking care of a sick child or for going to a doctor's appointment or for being pregnant in the first place.
Right. And that's one of the main reasons I wrote this book, was to say this is what it really looks like. Well, many of us think, oh, we solved this problem with the Family Medical Leave Act, right? Well, in truth, most people, and the Family Medical Leave Act, to back up for a second, says that workers should get 12 weeks unpaid after the birth of a child or for a family or medical emergency. But in fact, most working mothers don't stay home for 12 weeks with their child. Now, why is that? Partly, it's because the law covers only about a little more than half of all workers. So a whole bunch of people are left out because we did carve-outs. They did, you know, businesses that have fewer than 50 people. Workers don't have to comply with it, and it depends on how many hours you've worked and how long you've worked for the company and that sort of thing. But then the other part of the problem is that so many people who are covered can't afford to take it because it's unpaid. So when you talk about, well, let's let the market, you know, solve this problem, I mean, or you know, let's say let our skimpy law, you know, just do what it can in our market, what that actually means is that the people who do tend to get leave are the more highly paid, more highly educated workers. And on the lower end of the labor spectrum, you have most people not getting coverage and not able to stay home. And what I tried to, but I should say also that even on the upper ends, it's pretty skimpy and, you know, it's an inadequate amount, and some people don't get paid leave. But, they either don't get paid leave or they aren't able to take it for various reasons. So I think that the reality, you know, oh, we've solved this, or the idea that we've solved this problem versus the reality is pretty stark. I mean, some of the people I talked to in the book were home for just, you know, a couple weeks after giving birth. Some went back days after giving birth. You know, many people worked until just hours before giving birth, and that's very standard and very typical in this country.
The things you write about, access to health care, access to child care, and to leave, it seems that on all of them, the lower a person's income is, the less access they have to those things, and of course they're the ones who need it the most.
It's true, and right, and that's what happens when we leave it up to employers and leave it up to the marketplace, right? You know, we're basically operating on this in a way that we see these areas, and again, paid leave, flexible work options, and childcare as up to employers. If they want to help with these things, well, then great. Then we put them on lists of good companies to work for, and perhaps we pat them on the back. But we certainly don't do anything to people who don't do it. And as a result, you know, in the marketplace, a lot of people, the majority of companies don't consider it their obligation to deal with any of this stuff. And so most workers are without, again, paid leave, and certainly they're without child care. That is not a responsibility that most employers take on. And yet at the same time, it's not something that we've really taken on as a government. And so what's happened, we haven't taken on as a country, and that means that we have most families now struggling to pay for childcare. Those who use it struggle. I mean, for poor people, it's about a third of their income. Poor people who use childcare spend about a third of their income on it, which is mind-boggling, I think. But also, for many people who earn more, it's still quite a struggle. It's often the first or second biggest expense, and when you look at all expenses like rent, and mortgage, and food, car payments, all, you know, childcare is really up there. And yet, while other countries seem to take that on as, again, a public responsibility to some degree, we really haven't.
We're talking to Sharon Lerner, author of the new book, The War on Moms. It's interesting. I mean, you write that there's an attitude that people think that having a child is a choice, kind of like getting a puppy or a kitten is a choice. And you've got this cute little thing kicking around the house, but it's really your sole responsibility, rather than this is the future of our society, and they are utterly worth investing in, just as the way we invest in all the infrastructure of our society, because they are going to either be healthy or not so healthy 20 years from now.
Right, and they're going to be expensive if they're not so healthy, you know, if we really
exactly.
want to talk about it in those terms. But yeah, it's a tricky thing because, of course, when you have a child, well, ideally, you do so by choice. You make a decision to have a child, right? But the problem is that in this country, and I think it's partly because we have so little support, and it's you know, for workers beyond parents, I would say, and that, I think this is part of the problem, that people are overworked and underpaid. And I feel like in the workplace, you know, when there is so little flexibility and so few benefits, there's this sense of, like, don't infringe on what is mine. And I think that's part of what feeds it. But yeah, there, we have this idea that, well, once you've chosen to have a kid, well, then you must, you know, any misery that comes with it is an outgrowth of that choice. You know, you've chosen that misery as opposed to you've chosen to have a child, and perhaps it needn't be quite so miserable. There is an economist, Nancy Fulbright, who talks about the children as pets attitude, which is what I mentioned in the book, and I think that's sort of right on. It's this sense that we have children simply because they're cute and fun. You know, we're sort of into children, as opposed to, you know, it completely fails to recognize that children are the future of our country, and without them, we wouldn't have taxpayers or workers or citizens or soldiers. So I do think that's prevalent, and I do think, again, it's partly because of this sense that we're all kind of fighting over crumbs.
One of the problems that you talk about in the book is that when women are really stressed out, which so many mothers are, about money, about childcare, about housework, about trying to balance all of these things, they tend to see these stresses and these problems as their fault, or at the very least their problem, as opposed to a structural or policy problem that's going on around them.
It's so true. And, I had that sense perhaps a little bit before I started researching this book, but wow, talking to people all over the country, I really time and again was struck by the fact that women feel responsible for their failures, they personally, you know. And this is, you feel it in the marketing toward women and the books aimed at mothers, you know, stuff about how you can manage your time better and how you need to organize and sort of manage your psychic stresses and, you know, all this, you know, and all these, there's sort of a whole line of humor of, you know, I'm so overworked and give me another coffee and, you know, this kind of thing. And yet there's so little looking beyond ourselves and seeing the problem as bigger than us. And that's, again, part of what I wanted to do with this book, to say it's not you or me or my sister or your neighbor. It's a much bigger problem. It's a national problem, and it goes way beyond us.
Another problem that, or another kind of blaming tactic that people sometimes do is that the problem is men. And you start this one chapter talking about various men who don't do housework and expect their wives and mothers of their children who are full-time workers to do absolutely everything for them and who are leaving pizza crusts and, you know, on beds and horrible things. You want to just punch them when you read this. But that all said, they're not doing their share, yet they're not the main problem.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that one of the things I did come across was this sort of cultural lag, that there is a generation of men, perhaps, that has grown up being taken care of women who did not, by women, their mothers, who did not work, and then who are now married or in couples with women who do work, and yet so they sometimes have the same expectations, even though their partners are in the workforce, whereas their mothers were not. That said, as you mentioned, I do think the problem is much bigger than them, because if you look at what's happened to men, male workers over the past few decades, their stresses have increased, their work week has increased, their hours, their wages have decreased. And, you know, especially with the recession, you know, you see the tensions mounting, and I think it's mounting on entire family units. And I do think it's short-sighted, or it's whatever's going on with individual relationships, men aren't to blame for the overall problem.
There's a lot written about this in the media, but as you write about, it tends to focus on upper-income families. So you have this big New York Times article about very well-to-do women who are choosing to be full-time mothers, or you have this thing called, what is it called, the mommy wars, where between the probably false polarization between mothers
yes.
who work in the home and those who work out in the workforce. But what's wrong with these media pictures?
Well, I do think we focus on this really tiny slice, the elite of our country, and I understand why. I mean, it's appealing, you know, it's interesting, and it's fun. It's much more fun than thinking about the problems of everybody else. I mean, I like to call it the work-family dilemmas of the rich and famous, because it's so much of the literature about motherhood reads this way. You know, should we stay in our, should this woman stay in her law partner track job or and have a nanny, or should she stay home and perhaps, you know, I don't know, you know, knit or whatever. It's these false choices. It's this sense of, you know, of privilege. You know, I think we like to talk about these dilemmas as if most people actually have them, which is not true. And I cite a lot of books, and there are a lot of books like this, and I confess to enjoying reading them sometimes. And also, they have a place. Like, the story of professional women is important. They have, you know, come close to breaking the glass ceiling, as close as anyone, you know, has come so far. This generation of female professionals has done that, and it's interesting and important to read about. On the other hand, it's not what most people are going through. So I just want to take that all with a little more than a grain of salt. I just want to talk about everybody else and say, well, that's interesting. It's not actually, those dilemmas don't apply to most people who can't easily afford to ditch work. Or when you look at, I mean, you talked about that New York Times article, which was about opting out, you know, and it gave this sense that there are these privileged stay-at-home moms, and certainly there are some, right, who it's just, you know, what do I want to do? And it's all about, you know, fulfilling their own personal desires if there are no economic forces around them. Well, the truth is that when you look at most recent census numbers, stay-at-home moms tend to be less educated and have lower incomes than other women. So often what the people who are staying home, in fact, are people whose wages don't cover their child care costs. And I don't think it's a picnic, you know, which is, you know, not so much that, you know, it's been depicted as, you know, all fun and games, but I think that there are serious, serious financial consequences for most women who wind up at home.
And the choices that they have to make are not, should I stay in my law practice or get a nanny? There are things like, which bill can I let slide this month because I can't afford to pay for heat, electricity, child care, and food?
Right.
Not even getting into medical costs for the moment.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, I think that is the case for many more people than we like to think. And so I had this, one of the ideas I introduced in the book is that while we all sort of, many of us fixate on this tiny little sliver of elite people and like to somehow think that we are them, that their issues pertain to us, I think actually the opposite is true, that that the issues that we like to associate with poor people, really low-income people, and think, you know, things like not being able to afford child care, things like, you know, having to go back to work before you're, you know, needing your paycheck before your kid is 12 weeks old and having to go back, those kinds of things, you know, affect more and more, many more people than just the poor at this point. And so I think it's, I was talking about it as trickle up instead of that, you know, the issues affecting very high-end, you know, female employees, it's not that they trickle down. I think that actually we should be thinking of it as the issues of the poor are trickling up.
We're talking to Sharon Lerner about her book, The War on Moms. Another thing, just staying with the upper-income women for a moment, another thing that you bring out is that women who are in upper-level executive positions, by and large, don't have kids. Why is that?
Right, and that, I mean, that's the flip side of this, and is that, you know, there's this amazing study done by Sylvia Hewlett a few years ago that found, I believe, I'm going to get this right if I say that, women who earned over $100,000, fully 50% of them didn't have children. I think that was it. Anyway, it's a huge number. And what, you know, we tend to think that those women, professional women who don't end up having children, and then the women, low-income women who have children but perhaps no, not much income and not much professional standing, I think we tend to think of them as not having much in common for, you know, for obvious reasons. But what I was saying is they're actually struggling with or facing the same issues, which is the difficulty of doing both in our society that doesn't give a lot of help, doesn't give a lot of support for doing both, and certainly for doing both at the same time.
You devote an entire chapter to Mississippi. Why is that?
Well, I thought Mississippi offered a great chance to explore this idea that the pick yourself up by your bootstraps approach to poverty, and since some of what I'm writing about in the book is are issues of poverty and issues of female poverty, I went to Mississippi, which has the highest rate of female poverty, women's poverty in our country, and they also, and I think not coincidentally, have the lowest level of benefits that go to women and children. And also not coincidentally, I think they have some pretty serious restrictions on access to birth control and abortion. So what I end up saying is that in some ways these things are related. And certainly if you're looking at the pick yourself up by your bootstraps approach to poverty, we can say with some surety that it's not working very well there, that the fact of having low benefits hasn't in fact given women the push they need to become self-sufficient. It just means that without help and without a lot of control over their fertility, a lot of women have unintended pregnancies. And then once they have those children without help, what happens is they wind up in poverty. So it's not in some ways perhaps surprising, but I think it's a pretty clear illustration of the ways that approach has failed. And I think it's an approach that, to some degree, the entire country has taken. It's just that Mississippi is pretty extreme.
Can we just take a moment to talk about the fundamental hypocrisy of the family values policies that started in the 1980s, which are, of course, relevant to Mississippi and many other states?
Mm-hmm. I'd love to. What would you like to say about it?
Well, in other words, the idea that you are supposed to be a good girl and a happy mother and stay at home and raise your children and let the man bring home the bacon is absolutely impossible in the wage structure. And the policies that prohibit abortion don't ever take care of children once they're born.
Yeah, it's really true. And it's amazing. There's some a researcher named Jean Schrodel who did an analysis of state by state, looking at states that restrict abortion and states that, and also the amount of services for women and children that states provide. And she found an association between the restrictions and low levels of benefits for women and children. So, and again, Mississippi is an extreme example, but I think it's a nationwide association that, you know, when we that these things tend to go hand in hand. And yes, I do think it's hypocritical.
It's a little bit puzzling to me that the Democrats and the people who are opposed to that kind of thing haven't jumped on that.
I know. It's endlessly infuriating, really. You know, how has the term family values been allowed to go on, you know, as long as it's had, without being completely punctured as a ridiculous, a falsehood, you know? And, you know, as recently as, I would say not the Obama election, but the one before that, we heard that term being operative, you know, and it's sort of code word for anti-abortion, but within it is implicit also this opposition to the kinds of policies that I'm talking about, the kinds of policies that actually help families. It's bizarre.
The thing is, I mean, all of these problems and these hypocrisies are based in a number of myths, and one of the myths is that if you work hard, you can get a good-paying job, have a stay-at-home mother, have a nice house, and get on top of things. If you just have a work ethic and try hard, you can do it. The fact is that millions and millions and millions of jobs in the United States are dead-end jobs, and the employers will admit that, and they don't pay enough to even for a single person to live, much less a family.
Exactly. No, it's so true. And right. And there's been this like fundamental shift in our economy, and yet our family policy, really a lack of family policy, is based on this idea about, you know, this dual income family that was perhaps fictional back then, you know, and it's like now it's a laugh, right? Nobody's going to support families, as you say, on these kinds of incomes, right? And yet we're still basing our family policy around it.
To what extent did you look at racial differences and racial issues as they relate to issues of motherhood and poverty?
You know, I didn't address race head on, except in talking about the history of welfare a little bit. And I talk about this wonderful book, Killing the black body, and the, you know, and the fact that basically welfare, the early forms of welfare discriminated against African American women, and began as a program for mostly white widows to have income, and as the pool of women who were getting them became integrated, the benefits ended up dropping. So I address race there, but mostly I end up talking about class and really just economic issues. And many of the people I talk to are not white; they're all, you know, all different ethnicities. But I don't so much go into race beyond that.
We're talking to Sharon Lerner about her book, The War on Moms. Tell us about New Mexico's at-home infant care program.
Right. Well, I was in New Mexico, and I researched and ended up writing about a program there called At-Home Infant Care, which, as I understand it, is no longer up and running. But I thought it was really interesting because it's one of the programs that addresses a big problem, or it did address a problem. I'm not convinced that it was even the best way to address it, but it took a stab. And the problem is that many low-income women go back to work, as I said, way before 12 weeks, sometimes days after giving birth. And, you know, particularly, again, this is a problem for low-income women. So in New Mexico, you guys had this fabulous at-home infant care program, which took some of, and this was for welfare recipients or TANF recipients, and what it did was take money that would have gone to pay for subsidized child care and give it directly to the parents, and it could be to the mother or the father, and it allowed one of them to be home for a year, the first year of that infant's life. And it's an amazing thing because without it, there are a lot of women who end up going back to work very early, as I said, and often returning to work in childcare, which is one of the jobs that many low-income women have. And the irony, which is really terrible irony for many women, is that they are taking care of other people's kids while someone else is taking care of their own child. And there's this elaborate switcheroo, which in the end, you know, perhaps they walk away with a couple hundred dollars at the end of the month. But a lot of these women would prefer to be with their own children. And so one of the women that I write about was in this program, and she had two other children. Again, with both of them, she went back to work very quickly. And with this third one, she was able to stay home for a year. And it was a really wonderful year for her, and it was very interesting for her, for me to talk to her, and for her to have the comparison points, you know, to see, hey, this is what it's like when I run back to work, and, you know, and she wasn't able to nurse the first times around, and her kids got sick, and she was, of course, sleep deprived, and you know, and the second time, this was her third child, so she was plenty busy, but it was a real, you know, she talked about it like it was this honor for her to be able to spend any time with her child. And again, to look at other countries, I don't think this should be considered a stay-at-home mom kind of a thing as much as this is the sort of break that some other countries allow, a parenting break from work. So in other countries, there's often parental or maternity leave, but in addition, there's parenting leave, so that often people end up being able to stay home for something like a year. I mean, in Sweden, they get 18 months paid, and it's not unusual. So, and that's the kind of thing where, and then you perhaps could return to a job if you had leave, you know, with job protection, and that would enable you both to spend some time with that child, but also to go on with your career and keep working.
The story you told of the woman in New Mexico who had the three children and with the third one got that kind of help illustrates a bigger picture, which is that the first two, because she had to go back to work right away, were not able to breastfeed because her milk dried up, and they got asthma and allergies, which are often or sometimes consequences of not breastfeeding. And when somebody has asthma and bad allergies all their lives, that ends up being a burden on the medical system in which we live and on that person's ability to perform at work and all kinds of things. And so when you think about investing in families, just investing in letting a woman breastfeed for a year is actually an investment in the health of your entire society.
Right. And I think, you know, with breastfeeding, you know, our policy is really interesting because we have this, if you listen to the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, they recommend breastfeeding for a year. You talk and you look at the health organizations, the World Health Organization, this is what they're going to say, that people should breastfeed for a year. And, of course, so, and our policy, are, again, our family medical leave policy is that we have 12 weeks. But, again, in reality, the majority of women don't have 12 weeks. Majority of women are back to work before that. So what is going on there? Well, theoretically, they're going to pump, right? They're going to pump breast milk. But in reality, again, most people don't have what they would need to be able to do that. They don't have the privacy to pump. They don't have refrigeration so they can store the milk, and they don't have the appropriate breaks in their work. So in truth, we end up, most of the women I talked to who went back to work were not able to continue for any serious length of time because it just wasn't viable for this incredible variety of reasons. So it's interesting. We have that, you know, of course you should breastfeed for a year, and in reality most people can't. Most working people certainly can't. And so I think this was something people felt terrible about. They cried when they talked to me about this because they want to, their children want to, and they can see, sometimes they can see the health effects, they read about the health effects. And here we are saying, well, you should do this, and then, well, of course, here's our answer, pumping. Well, let's you know, I just feel like let's be honest and realistic about what this entails and what our workplace policies are and the fact that really it isn't possible for most people. And again, the end result is women end up feeling terrible. And, of course, that their children suffer too. But I just feel like it's hypocrisy, but it's a little bit, it's more like a dishonesty. You know, we're being disingenuous when we say this is what you should do because it's actually not feasible.
How are other countries that you studied actually solving some of these problems in a way that is harmonious and makes for healthy mothers and children and families?
Well, you know, it varies as according to issue. When you look at child care, in some ways child care just comes down to money. There are many countries that do much better than we do, that have public systems, that have sliding scales in which the vast majority of people participate. So families, you know, have in France and in Belgium is another country that does very well. In Sweden, they have these publicly funded systems. In the countries that do well, they can spend around 10 times as much as we do per child. So that's kind of your answer, you know. And again, pretty much anybody who... It's made affordable for pretty much anybody who wants to participate, everyone. And I think because everyone participates, it ends up being high quality. And we have very, the word isn't segregated. We have stratified, you know, system here where we really have like, you know, good, bad. If you have tons of money, you can buy fabulous child care here. But the fact is that without subsidization, most people can't pay for that, and we end up having pretty low-quality care. So, I think with child care, it's a matter of money in many ways. And we did talk quite a bit about paid leave, and this really seems like a matter of political will. And in other countries, again, you know, it's not only paid, but it's often much, much longer. In terms of flexible work options, that's something that's pretty interesting to me. I went to the Netherlands to look at how that country does it in particular. They have this fabulous, fabulous part-time economy. But beyond that, before I get into the Netherlands, I should say that many other countries, like, for instance, the entire European Union has regulated employers so that they are required to protect part-time workers. Let me explain. They need to have prorated pay and benefits, for one. So that means that you can't pay someone less per hour just because they're working part-time. But another part of a big part of the difference is that here, health coverage is so often tied to full-time employment, right? And so here you're talking about a pay cut and probably a status cut and also often not getting health benefits. But anyway, to go back to the Dutch system, what they do is beyond the European Union regulations, they say that pretty much any employer has to honor the request of a full-time worker who wants to go part-time. And it's not just about parents. It's really for pretty much any reason. And so a big, big chunk of workers there do work part-time. 75% of working women work part-time, and somewhere around a quarter of men. And so when I went there, I talked to couples in which both partners worked part-time when their children were little. And, sometimes they worked 4 days a week, sometimes sometimes three. And it ended up, you know, from what I could see, I did not do a scientific, investigation of it, but I did, meet, 10 couples who had this arrangement. And from my perspective, it was enviable, a lot saner than anything I've witnessed or experienced here.
You tell in your book some really heartbreaking stories of people. One couple in particular with whom you start the book had a very happy, decently paid, kind of semi-yuppie lifestyle, and the woman had been very sick and thought she couldn't have children. She got pregnant, had a child who ended up having a disability, and they were plunged into poverty, debt, and just desperation almost overnight. And some of the things that you're talking about, none of that would have happened if the woman had had proper health insurance and if she'd had proper child care.
Right. And by proper health insurance, we should say that she was insured, She was insured. It just, she had maxed out the whatever you call it. She'd gone beyond the ceiling, and certain things weren't covered, as most people who are insured, realize that, you're quote unquote covered, but then of course, like the Michael Moore Sicko movie goes into it, you're often left to, with huge gaps in coverage. She ended up with a huge bunch of medical bills, and her daughter was sick as a result of her difficult pregnancy. Yeah, and she was not able to take advantage of the FMLA. She was working for a law firm overseeing their computers, managing their computers. And even though she had actually worked at the company for several years, she had been a consultant at first, and then, it was less than 12. She'd only been officially employed by them for less than 12 months, so they were under no obligation to allow her any time off when her daughter was very sick. And her daughter had been diagnosed as partially paralyzed when she was, 6 months old or something. And at that point, this woman, Devorah Gartner is her name, she wanted to take some time off, but she wasn't able to. And so even though she had these mounting medical bills, she ended up, she actually quit her job, and she spiraled down, and, ended up just in huge debt, and they sold their home at a loss, and they ended up in a financial hole that I would say they were still in to some degree, even though the child is now 9. And the thing is, we think of this as, what a tragedy, what a travesty, how alarming. And it is all those things, but it is not uncommon, actually. What happened to them was just a pretty hearty dose of bad luck, which unfortunately happens quite often. It's part of life. And so, but this kind of thing without a real safety net in place does mean, it means terrible things for a family.
And she, like many other people whom you describe, went to her employer and said, my child needs extra care. May I work you know, one less day a week or whatever it was, and they treated her like scum.
They did, and there is this sort of it's not our problem approach to things, but you know, ultimately it's all of our problems. You know, it's only not our problem until it happens to you. You know, and I mean, what I think is that this is Devorah Gartner's problem. This is her husband's problem. But I think you know, it's ultimately not just a shame. It's not just a terrible, inhuman thing for us to be doing. I think it's also a drag on our economy. It's our country's problem. It's something that we all suffer from if that happens.
Exactly. Now, are there any movements within the Obama presidency and political movements going on the ground to rectify some of these things?
Sure. Obama has some funding for child care in his 2011 budget, which is exciting. It hasn't been voted on yet, but it gives a sense that he gets the issue and gets that it's important. It's nowhere near what we need, but it's a little bit, it's encouraging. He also has some money for, I think it's $50 million for some state paid leave programs, which is exciting. As I mentioned before, there are two paid leave programs in states now. There's New Jersey and California. Washington already passed one, but hasn't been put into effect yet. So the rest of us still need to catch up, and he has some money to help us do that. Ultimately, of course, we need a national law, but I think that with a lot of these things, they do tend to trickle upward. They tend to start with the states, and once we get to some number with unpaid leave, we had, I think it was 34 states that had it, and then we ended up ultimately with the FMLA. So I think that it's exciting that he has that. Now, for part-time work options, I'm not that optimistic. There was a workplace flexibility forum at the White House, which shows that they're thinking about it, but the specifics are, you know, I haven't heard anything specific that seems very promising at this point.
Sharon Lerner is author of the book, The War on Moms, On Life in a Family-Unfriendly Nation. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features an interview with Christine Jensen and the monthly New Orleans Hour. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.